Melanie Mitchell is next. She is a professor of computer science at Portland State University. While working on her PhD, she co-authored Copycat, which is an artificial intelligence program that creates analogies. In addition to her work on AI, she has done extensive research in the areas of evolutionary computing and cellular automata. She is the author or editor of 5 books, with titles including Analogy Making as Perception and An Introduction to Genetic Algorithms. Professor Mitchell's most recent book, Complexity, A Guided Tour, won the 2010 Phi Beta Kappa Science Book Award. Please give a warm welcome to Professor Melanie Mitchell.
Okay. In 1985, the mathematician Giancarlo Rota asked, I wonder whether or when AI will ever crash the barrier of meaning. In my talk today, I'm going to explore what it might mean to understand or perceive meaning, or why meaning is still a barrier for AI, and what it would take to unlock this barrier. I'm going to try and do this all in 20 minutes. The question of understanding meaning has come to the fore of consciousness in a wider community than the AI community by IBM's Watson computer, which appeared on television and gave at least the strong appearance of understanding natural language. So one of the things that I'm going to ask is, to what extent did it understand language, and what does that mean to understand? So the first thing to do is to give my own definition of understanding, which is the ability to fluidly adapt one's knowledge so as to perceive appropriate analogies in new situations. So here I'm bringing analogy to the forefront of what it means to understand, and I'm going to expand on that. So when we think about analogy, typically we think about very high-level thinking, maybe even the source of rare intellectual insight. So Darwin made a famous analogy when he said that biological competition is like economic competition. Yukawa won a Nobel Prize for making an analogy between the nuclear force and the electromagnetic force, and in particular, making an analogy between electrons and an at that time unknown particle which mediates the nuclear force. Von Neumann perhaps jump-started the computer age by thinking about the computer as an analogy to the brain. And in reverse of that, Simon and Newell jump-started artificial intelligence by saying that the brain, in fact, is like a computer. These are all very high-level analogies made by maybe the smartest among us. But actually, the way that I view analogy and think its real import is in more everyday thought, the kinds of things that we say every day. For example, as the source of what we might call labels for situations. So an example, you hear a piece of music and you say, that sounds like Mozart. So you're in some sense making an analogy between something you know of Mozart and this new piece of music that you're hearing. It's another Vietnam. People will describe some abstract situation, some political, economic, military situation as being another Vietnam. And we say this, it's kind of just ordinary language, but it's really making quite a sophisticated analogy between two abstract situations. Another example might be a cover-up. We recognize this abstract concept of cover-up in many different situations, very flexibly. Idioms like the pot calling the kettle black. That's something that we learn as a child, and we're able to apply it to different kinds of situations, or things like people in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. So we say these things without even knowing consciously that we're making quite sophisticated analogies, but that's exactly what we're doing. And in fact, in even more ordinary situations, you probably have heard yourself say things like, been there, done that. Well, those words, that word, done that, can be used very flexibly in the same way that you might say, the same thing happened to me, in a situation where it's not at all the same thing as the thing that happened to your friend. But it's analogous in some kind of more abstract way. If I were in your shoes, even ditto. So all of these things are sort of the hidden analogies that are at the core of all of our conceptualization, or you might call it abstraction categorization. I see all of these as on a spectrum of cognitive analogy making. So again, to say understanding is the ability to fluidly adapt one's knowledge to different situations so as to perceive appropriate analogies. Well, I haven't defined what I meant by appropriate. I'm going to try and do that a little bit later. But to sort of sum up in a kind of a slogan, I would say that analogy is the vehicle by which concepts mean. So I want to tell you a little bit about my own journey to thinking about meaning and artificial intelligence. So back in the early days of computers, my father was a computer designer. This is a picture of him working on a very early computer in 1959. And he helped found an early startup computer company called Scientific Data Systems, which made mainframe computers. It got bought out by Xerox in the 60s. And he ended up retiring at a relatively young age and rebuilding one of these computers, the Sigma 5, in our den. And I grew up with this as kind of like another sibling in the family. It wore a button that said, "I pray in Fortran." And as a young child, I wondered, does the computer actually pray in Fortran? When we're asleep, maybe it's there praying. And this was something that struck me as being, you know, a good possibility. And it kind of carried me through my intellectual development and got me interested in the question of, do computers think? Can they think? How can they think? In 1984, I actually decided to go into the field of artificial intelligence. I went to graduate school at the University of Michigan to work with Douglas Hofstadter, who was working on modeling how people make analogies, and ended up writing a book about all of our work together with a number of other graduate students called Fluid Concepts and Creative Analogies. And this book actually has and you see it's called Computer Models of the Fundamental Mechanisms of Thought. And this book has a nice distinction in that it was the very first book ever sold on Amazon. So that was kind of a coup. So one of the programs that I worked on with Hofstadter was called Copycat. Another student, Jim Marshall, worked on an extension called Metacat. And these were computer programs that explored human-like understanding and meaning via analogy. And what they did was made analogies in very restricted domains, but they made them in the way that we believed humans might make them in more real-world situations. So an example, we used strings of letters to represent abstract situations. So we have a situation up there on the top, ABC changes to ABD. And then we have another situation, PPQQRR. And these are situations with objects, relationships between objects, actions that take place, a change of a letter. And we want to say, what's the analogous change from ABC to ABD to PPQQRR? Okay, so what I'm going to do is show you a little movie of Copycat running, and you'll see that the way it works is that many different relatively simple agents try and formulate relationships, structures, correspondences, and so on. So please start the movie. So you'll see the action of lots of simple explorations. The program's stochastic. That means that it makes random decisions that get increasingly channeled into more and more focused explorations. So you can see it's structuring the bottom string by understanding that there are groupings of letters, and that maybe the groupings of letters are more important than the individual letters. It notices that ABC is a alphabetically increasing sequence in the alphabet, and it tries to make correspondences between the concepts it finds in the top string and the concepts it finds in the bottom string. And it has a network of concepts that I'm not showing here that are interacting with the perceptual agents to try and make a coherent sense of this situation. And it finally comes up with an answer, PPQQSS. So what it's doing here is noticing that the top string, it discovers that the change on the top string is that the rightmost letter is changed to its successor. If we did that to the bottom string, however, took that literally, we would get PPQQRS, which seems like a very literal-minded answer. But instead, it says, well, letter in the bottom situation is really not to be taken completely literally, but a little bit flexibly. So I put it in quotes here, and in fact, it gets translated into the notion of letter group, which we call a conceptual slippage. Another example is if we just turn the bottom string around, we reverse it. Well, in this case, the structure changes a bit. Here's what the program comes up with on a particular run. And it says, okay, now we change the rightmost letter to its successor on the top. But here now, because the string is reversed, we not only have to make slippage between letter and letter group, but also between successor and predecessor. And last example is this problem. ABC changes to ABD. What does XYZ change to? Well, we don't allow, the program doesn't get the answer XYA because it doesn't know about circularity in the alphabet. Here's one of the answers it comes up with, where it says A is at the front of the alphabet, Z is at the end of the alphabet, so they correspond, and C corresponds to X, and so now we have multiple slippages where we would change the leftmost letter to its predecessor. The program's stochastic, so it can also create other answers to this problem. One of the ones it comes up with is XYD, where it says, well, change the rightmost letter to a D, and does the same thing down here. So that's a little bit what we might call blockheaded. And then it can get answers like this, where it actually figures out that the rightmost letter corresponds to the leftmost letter, but it keeps the literal change the letter to D. So it's making a creative leap in some sense, but keeping something very rigid and literal in another sense. So this might be called a kind of a crackpot answer. Okay, so understanding is a continuum, obviously. Maybe it's even a step function. But we might have something we might call shallow understanding, which is kind of literal application of our concepts to a new domain, or deeper understanding where we actually are able to fluidly adapt our concepts to a new situation by using conceptual slippages. So in short, I believe that the work we did on copycat is not limited to this letter domain, but really extends more generally to many different domains, and the mechanisms that we modeled will actually work in more realistic domains. I'll talk about that in a minute. But just as a definition now, in short, deep understanding is the ability to make appropriate analogies in a vast array of new, previously unseen situations. I wrote a book called Analogy Making as Perception, which showed copycat working in this sort of vast array of different situations in this limited letter string world. My advisor, Doug Hofstadter, went even further and said analogy isn't just perception, but it's actually the core of cognition. And he has a new book coming out very soon that gives his view on this whole idea of analogy as core of cognition. So bringing back to a program like Watson, I was really impressed by Watson when I saw it on television. But I guess the question I asked the most was, does it cross the barrier of meaning? There were a number of people talking about Watson as if it actually did, in some sense, understand meaning. From the IBM press release, Watson understands natural language, breaking down the barrier between people and machines. Dan Cerutti, who is one of the main people on IBM promoting this project, Watson is able to understand ambiguous human language. I know some people who can't do that. Ray Kurzweil last year at this event said that there's no way that Watson could answer these Jeopardy queries if it had no understanding of language. It is understanding some fairly subtle language, including puns, similes, and metaphors. So this is a pretty strong claim. On the other side, though, Stanley Fish, a philosopher writing in the New York Times, said that Watson's performance is a wholly formal achievement that involves no knowledge. The computer doesn't know anything in the relevant sense of know. So who's right here? Well, I wanted to show you a couple of clips from Watson. Can you start this movie, please, to try and get this idea across?
Good morning, everybody. Thank you for being here. What do you say we play Jeopardy? All right. Let's get right into the Jeopardy round. These categories: a man, a plane, a canal, Erie, chicks dig me, children's book titles, My Michelle, MC5, and finally, vocabulary. Ken, you're in the first position. Please make a selection.
I've never said this on TV. Chicks dig me for 200, please, Jimmy.
Kathleen Kenyon's excavation of this city mentioned in Joshua showed the walls had been repaired 17 times. Watson.
What is Jericho?
Correct.
Okay. So, chicks dig me. It's a pun, you know, it's a category about female archaeologists. It's a kind of typical Jeopardy query. Okay, can you show the next video? Oops, I'm sorry. This one. The second one.
Watson.
What is Creed?
Yes.
Let's finish Chicks Dig Me.
Okay, so Watson said, let's finish Chicks Dig Me. And everybody laughed. So why did they laugh? I asked a lot of people this question. Why are the people laughing? And everybody said about the same thing. Well, Watson, you know, it's like a computer. It has this robotic voice, and it has no idea what chicks are or what it means that chicks dig me, and it's kind of funny. Okay, so what does it mean? Well, understanding the meaning of a concept, to understand sort of chicks dig me, being able to recognize situations in which the concept applies, being able to fluidly use the concepts in new situations, and being able to make appropriate analogies. So when Ken Jennings said, chicks dig me, he had a certain understanding of it that allowed him to, for instance, know that there are certain situations where chicks dig me is maybe an appropriate label, and other kinds of situations where maybe it's not that appropriate. Okay. So, did Watson understand the meaning of chicks dig me? Well, I would say no, at least not in any deep way in the sense that I'm defining understanding. But then another question, did copycat understand the meaning of ABC goes to ABD? Much less complicated concept. But I would say yes, it did in its own simple domain, because it was able to take that concept and apply it fluidly to a vast array of other situations in its domain. So in a way, copycat is chinking away at this barrier of meaning. Okay, so I wanted to tell you a little bit about how I'm trying to extend these ideas from copycat and analogy in a more realistic domain. What we're working on now is visual concepts via analogy. So here's a simple visual concept that we've all seen, the concept of walking a dog. Okay, and we might have a sort of a paradigm for, or semantic network, or what you might call an ontology for dog walking, where you have a person holding a leash attached to a dog who's walking. Okay, but then there's some issues, like here's a lot of dogs, and here's people running, not walking. And so we might have to extend our concepts from dog to dog group, or from walking to running, allowing conceptual slippage. Here's a picture of somebody walking a very unhappy-looking cat. Okay, walking an iguana with its tail taking the place of a leash. These are all sort of in the same category, general category, of this dog walking concept. Okay, so here's a different kind of dog walking. Here's a dog that's riding a skateboard, somebody on a Segway. This is a device you can buy for $800 where you power your bike with a treadmill and you also walk your dog in the treadmill. So, you know, there's all kinds of dog walking. It goes on and on and on. So this really illustrates the remarkable fluidity of human concepts, that we really recognize these visual or any kind of abstract concept in a very fluid way. And, you know, we have to start thinking about how do people and how could we get computers to make the right kinds of conceptual slippages. Here's a more abstract idea of dog walking. You know, we've all done with our yo-yos. Here's a dog walking picture at different levels. And then if you go to the internet, you get even more abstract metaphors. What dog walking taught me about networking, meditate like you walk the dog, your lawyer on a short leash, a thing you can put on top of your wedding cake to illustrate a metaphor with marriage, and so on. So the singularity's been called the appearance of smarter-than-human intelligence. But my version is a little different. I would call what I'm looking for is the appearance of a machine that crosses the barrier of meaning, that uses concepts as fluidly as humans do in a broad range of domains. When will AI cross the barrier of meaning? I don't think it's going to be very soon. Marvin Minsky, pioneer of AI, said that one thing we've learned from 6 decades of research on AI is that easy things are hard. Easy things, the things easy for humans, like fluid concepts, are the hardest things for computers. So how will AI cross the barrier of meaning? Eventually, a key component will be via programs that make their own analogies. So let me finish by making an analogy, and that is that analogy is the key to the barrier of meaning. Thank you.
All right, we've got time for a few questions. Let's start over here. We've got a couple hands up on the aisle.
Can you put up your definition of meaning and tell us why Watson doesn't satisfy it?
Well, my definition of meaning is to be able to use knowledge and concepts in a fluid way, making appropriate analogies in new situations that haven't been seen before. And so Watson is able to perhaps make sense in some way of concepts like chicks dig me, but I don't think it has the ability to sort of fluidly recognize an appropriate chicks dig me situation across a vast array of different situations.
Let's stay over here. Most hands are over here.
Hi.
Wait, hold on. The mic will come to you next. The mic's behind you.
Are there specific improvements that we need to make in terms of technique to get to a singularity-like meaning machine, or is it just a matter of we need to just keep making faster computers? Have we discovered enough about the processes?
No, we haven't discovered enough about the processes.
What's left, roughly?
We have to understand how concepts are structured, how to learn concepts in such a way that we can then apply them in this flexible, fluid way to new situations. So we don't know how to do that yet. People are working on that. I'm trying to work on that, but it's still quite a hard and unsolved problem.
How about down here right in front?
I'm impressed that you're going to visual inputs, but to make understanding, you also have to have sensory inputs like touch and scent and all kinds of other things that help you make meaning. How would a machine ever really understand chicks dig me at that level?
I agree that eventually, to understand at the level of human understanding, we need to have the same sensory inputs as humans. And I think people are trying to do that. They're trying to give computers different kinds of sensory inputs, visual, auditory, haptic, and so on. I'm not sure that's any, you know, complete combination of those is really required for meaning. Not all humans have all those senses. But I think that obviously some kind of way to sense the world is essential.
Right here in the middle.
I wonder if you can get a solution to the problem if you were to educate a computer the way children are educated, because when a child is born, it knows nothing about language. And if you just had, you know, massive database and massive computing power and took the thing through, you know, Dick, Sally, and Jane, and, you know, this is a cat, and sequentially made the computer learn information in the same order that children learned information if you couldn't get a computer to understand meaning in that scenario?
That's a very good question. I think it's unknown that whether or not children know anything about language when they're born. There's some thought that there's certain brain structures that have evolved that we have intrinsically that we don't learn. That's still an open question. I do think that, you know, the process of learning and development is absolutely essential for having understanding meaning. And we don't know exactly how to get computers to learn in that way yet.
There's one down here on the aisle.
Do you have any favorite practices or exercises for developing your analogizing mind?
that's a good question. I don't. But what I've learned to do is to listen for analogies. I've learned to become a collector of analogies. And I think that helps me think about what analogy is, its breadth, and how to better understand how the mind works by looking at it through the lens of analogy.
Anybody? How about right here in the middle?
In what sense do you think that copycat is doing a better job with meaning in its domain of new letter sequences than Watson is in its domain of encountering new Jeopardy queries? It seems to me like they're both pretty narrow, but not entirely narrow domains.
I don't think Watson is making any kind of analogies. It's not, it doesn't, for instance, notice that two questions, I don't think it notices that two questions might be similar in some kind of abstract structure. It's able to sort of identify, categorize questions by type in terms of being a pun or a historical question or something like that. So to that extent, it can do some kind of analogy, but I don't think it can do the kind of breadth of applying its knowledge in new domains that it hasn't seen before.
Got time for maybe two or three more. A lot more hands are up than that. How about right back here, just a couple off the aisle?
Tying in the earlier talk we saw from Professor Kahneman, analogy is one of the greatest bias-introducing things we humans do. We make faulty analogies all the time. And is it a good idea that we have a computer that makes a lot of analogies to try to discern the facts or a reality in a certain situation? It means it could conceivably make the same mistakes we would, but maybe even at a worse scale.
I personally think that we're going to make mistakes. We have to have this ability to make analogies in order to be intelligent. It's really the source of our intelligence. We will make mistakes, but those mistakes are in some sense a reflection of our ability to think. And so, you know, when people asking Professor Kahneman, how do we fix these bugs in our thinking? I'm not sure that fixing them is possible without sort of sacrificing something very essential in the way that we think. So I'm not so concerned about the biases that analogy making introduces. I think that's part and parcel of the whole power of our own ability to think in this very fluid way.
So a hand up here toward the back that's been up for a while.
Thanks. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but do you think there's a connection between understanding and a sense of humor?
Totally. Yes, I think that's a really good point. And a lot of our humor comes from analogy in the sense, so but sort of bad analogies. So Chicks Dig Me, you know, is one example. It's funny in that context because it's being really, you know, it sets up a kind of expectation in our minds, but then we figure out it's actually being taken very literally. And so, you know, the people laugh when I give the letter string example of, you know, PPQQRD, because it's, you know, we've set up this expectation of a situation, and then we see this very literal interpretation of it. So I think that sort of bad analogies are a lot of what lies behind humor.
How about one more quick one right here?
Yes, I have one. To what extent do you believe that a hierarchical model analogous to our biological cortex is sufficient for meaning?
Sorry, you said a hierarchical model
analogous to our
biological cortex. I think our biological cortex, along with all the other parts of the brain, are what give meaning we with our senses. So if we are able to develop something analogous to that, I believe that will be sufficient for meaning. It's the that analogous part of it is the key, sort of what that means. And that's what I think people don't yet know, sort of how much we need to really imitate.
Professor Melanie Mitchell, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.